Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Which one is that? That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home, those boys.
That's... Yeah. They have asked for that, really.
Well, you can laugh. I was the World Cup.
I'm a little bit of an idealist. But having said that, I want to be like me.
You don't know what you're talking about.
What did you know?
I managed to stay alive for 6 days.
I'm going to need it.
I'd say it to your face, and I'll say it to you now.
I'm down Twanfield, and we'll see them, won't we?
What you doing down here, you shawny man?
I apologise if I sound a little rattled on today's Second Cabins Football Podcast. Hi, Ken.
Oh, and how are you?
Well, I'm rattled, as I just mentioned. It's just that I recorded Match of the Day 2 last night. I only got around to watching it before coming into studio today, so I got to see everything all together.
How do you mean everything all together?
Well, all the matches, because I'd seen some of the football, not all of the football. You know, and then when it's all in one, you know, you see things, you just feel it as a full day of football.
Yeah.
And that's how I felt Sunday's football this Monday, early afternoon.
Right.
And it's just turned everything I believed about the Premier League on its head.
So.
Well, I'm watching Alan Shearer and Danny Murphy saying the problem with Ole Gunnar Solskjaer's Man United is the shackles are on.
Oh, no.
The shackles are just on. They approached yesterday's match against West Ham with too rigid a game plan, and nobody in the team was willing to go out there and express themselves.
What's the whole point of the shackles?
Why are you bringing the shackles back? Mm. And then you had Arsenal approaching the last 10 minutes of a match, two goals down. No, not two goals down.
One
they were
goal
a goal
there.
Down. But showing the heart of a collective
down.
Lion. Yeah, man down as well. Heart of a lion by turning things around for a gutsy and vital win. I just don't know what's going on in the Premier League world. Thankfully, the Frank Lampard as saviour narrative remains untouched, no matter how many games he loses boss. Yeah. The opening question in the post-match interview was along the lines of, Frank, standing ovation from the crowd at the end. What a performance your guys gave today. After a performance that drops them into the bottom half of the table, which is a disgrace for Chelsea.
That's amazing
to
stuff.
To be in the bottom half of the table.
You know, Chelsea didn't lose in the league till November last year. You know, they were... This time, this day last year, or September 22nd actually, was the last day that a team other than Liverpool or Man City was top of the league, and that was Chelsea.
Yeah.
They dropped off top spot thanks to a couple of draws, but didn't actually lose in the league until November. Obviously went all the way in the Europa League, which was a complicating factor for their season, but finished third. At the end of it in the slow horse race. Now, the slow horse race seems to be continuing into this season. Chelsea have slowed down slightly. They're now 11th. They have a goal difference of negative goal difference.
Minus one now, yeah.
And they're getting beaten. The second consecutive home game, they're losing. And honestly, the crowd was just like in raptures. It was amazing. It was absolutely amazing. Yeah. It's just, you know, nothing is either good or bad, but thinking makes it so. You know, you just need to... Just believe. Sometimes it works better if you screw your eyes really tightly shut and bunch your fists into balls and just believe. And things just feel better.
The problem with this slow horse race beginning so early in the season among the big clubs, you know, just around the top four, is that they're giving a lot of other clubs, your Leicester Cities of this world, an opportunity to actually, you know, just have a solid season and qualify for the Champions League. We'll chat to Gabriele Mercati anyway about that, about Chelsea. And Laurie Whitwell of The Athletic is going to be on to talk about what's going wrong at Man United. But first...
80 minutes
up because there's an incredible gong gone off here.
Yeah, my apartment's going to be stacked full of lads.
Probably 10 lads coming over.
For the whole thing, so it's going to be absolute carnage. It's going to be absolute carnage.
Absolute carnage.
It's going to be absolute carnage.
Absolute carnage. It's going to be stacked full of lads. It's going to be 10 lads coming absolute over.
Carnage.
Simon, I don't know what you're doing toweling off there. Keep that top off and hit that bong one more time.
What an opening weekend it was in Japan. The Scots have been vanquished and Breffni is no doubt having the time of his life. Next up, it's a match with the host nation that will all but guarantee top spot in the pool, assuming we win. And it's a match that we can all experience together. If you haven't already made plans for Saturday morning, we hereby invite you to the Liberty Hall Theatre to watch the rugby and then settle in for a live Second Captain's podcast immediately after the full-time whistle. Owen Redden and Andrew Trimble will be there. And if you think David O'Doherty would miss an event like this, you need your head examining. David will be there, and there'll be the usual live show nonsense from Murph and Ken, who I'm sure will provide searing rugby insight for the occasion that's in it. World Service members have already snapped up most of the tickets, but there are some left, and you can get them now on secondcaptains.com/live. Doors open at 7:30 for an 8:15 kickoff. This is an early day out with the Second Captains. You're going to have more fun than you ever thought possible on a Saturday morning. Tickets on sale right now on secondcaptains.com/live. And while I'm in live show mode, just to mention, tomorrow for World Service members only, listen closely people, tomorrow we will bring you all the details on how to be a part of Richie Sadler's book launch. That's correct, our boy Richie has only gone and written an incredibly powerful memoir called Recovering. We'll be recording a live show at the official launch at the Chocolate Factory. That's going to be in early next month in Dublin, and Richie wants to share his special occasion with our much loved members. Those details coming your way tomorrow. On with today, Ken.
So yeah, I guess the Chelsea Liverpool game was the big one of the weekend, and a very good win for Liverpool at the end, because it looked as though they were kind of really wobbling. It was a weird game because it seemed as though Liverpool were kind of in control and clearly the stronger team for about 55 minutes, particularly in the 10 minutes after half time when they came out, they were winning 2-0. And it looked as though they were now going to completely demolish Chelsea in the second half. There was just total domination in Chelsea's half, creating a stream of chances. And then for some reason, it was as though they kind of thought, well, not that this is in the bag exactly, but like kind of similar to Napoli the other day, when it was like, you know, it's a marathon. It's not you don't win a marathon by absolutely pelting along at like full speed from mile one. I mean, you could have told them that.
Sure, I could, yeah. Although yeah, the top guys, if you ever see them, it looks like they're sprinting.
It looks like they are, but actually they're leaving a little bit in the tank. So they then started to slow the game down. Now, I would be interested in knowing whose idea really that was, because it seemed to me as though Jurgen Klopp was getting angry about it. Particularly with Adrian, whether Adrian just sort of thought, I'm going to be a bit clever here and start, you know, there's no reason for me to really rush this goal kick. Mm. You know, I've got to survey my options. We're playing the ball out from the back here. You know, I'm not going to be rushed into this. You know, I'm going to take my time. I'm going to take my sweet time. Should I really put the ball down at this corner of the 6-yard box, or would it perhaps be better for our build-up if I move the ball over to that corner? And the crowd were sort of getting on top then. The crowd were, oh, this is... Oh, yeah. And the referee intervened, Michael Oliver. He told Jordan Henderson. Henderson seemed to then be telling Adrian, hurry up, you know, get on with the play. And eventually this happened. Then there was more dithering. Now, again, was this intentional? Was Trent Alexander-Arnold, who had the ball in his hands, taking in throw, was he thinking, you know, I'm just going to, you know, annoy Chelsea even more here by slowing the game down even more and taking ages over this? Or is this because of the work of Thomas Groenemark, the throw-in coach at Liverpool, who's teaching them to improve their efficiency at throw-in situations, such that they're now winning like 80% of throw-in ball or whatever the terminology is in this particular area? You know, Alexander-Arnold isn't just going to lash the ball up the line in the time-honored traditional fullbacks. He's waiting to play the right pass, and waiting too long to play the right pass, gets booked. And it was almost as though this kind of changed the momentum of the game. You know, it was like this, Liverpool having been in control, sort of decided to declare. You know, it was like, you know, we think we've got this now.
We declare at 2-0.
Which ultimately was enough to win the game, but only because Mason Mount missed the chance that he could easily have scored late on, and there was another who had the header. There was a header just wide of the post, which looked like it was going to go in. Kante obviously was the one who scored the goal, which was a really good. I mean, like a little clockwork mouse, just running suddenly, and it was a strange one as well. You could see that Matip and Van Dijk were standing in front of Kante, but neither sort of made any effort to block him, as though they were inviting him to have a shot. And you're thinking in hindsight, guys, like, he's not that bad at shooting. Like, we know that Kante is maybe not the, you know, the world's greatest attacking midfielder in the way that he's the world's greatest defensive midfielder. Still, though, have a bit of respect.
I think they might have thought Fabinho was going to make a little more of an effort. He sort of ghosted past Fabinho, who immediately gestured for the centre halves to come out, lads. He's kind of gone by me here.
I've completely lost this. I don't know how he's managed to do that, but he's made me look like a tree.
And maybe they just thought that, this can't be happening. And then, there probably is in the back of their heads. This is, you know, it's not Tammy Abraham that is sticking in the top corner, so we might be okay, but no.
Yeah. Well, you know, they ended up getting away with it, even though I thought they were kind of comfortably the better team until they started to, you know, I think it's the whole idea, if it was a conscious, like a team strategy, let's slow this down now. Let's hold them, contain, frustrate. I think that's quite a dangerous game to play in a match like that against a team that's playing at home, actually has lots of good players. You know, look at the Chelsea team. I know that Frank Lampard has been picking, you know, it's been all young British. But actually, if you look at the team yesterday, there was Kante, Kovacic, Jorginho. We're talking about a experienced midfield unit of internationals to sort of give them 35 minutes to come at you, to really throw everything at you, because they're losing and they're going to take risks with the crowd on their side like that. That's dangerous. That's a difficult one to contain. So Liverpool got away with it, but they did get away with it. And now it's 15 wins in a row, if you count last season. I mean, imagine there had been no summer, it'd be 30 wins in a row now. You know, this summer has really taken the shine off this Jurgen Klopp record. But 5 points clear after six matches is a huge lead at this point. I mean, it's a crazy lead at this point. Obviously, it didn't really matter with 32 matches still to play, in that it can easily be overhauled. But to have gained 5 points in six matches is a phenomenal start to the season.
That's amazing. And it sets it up. It sets it up nicely. I don't know, Man City, we might get on to looking pretty remorseless this weekend, but imagine City were 5 points ahead, put it that way.
Yeah.
They'll be looking at a fairly grim season potentially.
It would potentially feel as though the title was a bit more decided than it does at this point. But, you know, after the game, there was this all-star panel of alphas on Sky, Mourinho, Souness and Keane.
Who was the alpha of the three?
Well, I haven't been on long enough together for a real pecking order to emerge.
Okay.
I mean, there's a couple of awkward moments. There was one when Souness, I think he was talking about the VAR decision that ruled out Chelsea's goal in the first half, where the debate was regarding whether the defence had time to reset. Mm. Was this the same phase of play? Did the offside take place in the same phase of play as the goal? And Souness said something like, well, sometimes it's difficult for us up here to judge, you know, having been out of the game for so long. And Mourinho just sitting next to him sort of twitching. Yeah. Some of us have been out of the game for longer than others, I guess. There was another one, Mourinho analysing the Firmino goal. He said, "Eight is a very important thing. A very important thing." And there was this almost sort of pregnant pause there. It was like, and it became clear he meant in the context of defending set pieces, particularly if you employ a zonal system. And everyone was able to exhale a little bit. But, you know, he said after the Chelsea game, I mean, the thing was, the whole crowd was like, oh, it's amazing. As though you'd qualified for the European Cup final. You know, not quite that level of celebration. But it was, you know, it was very positive, considering this is your second successive defeat at home. You still haven't won at home all season, and blah, blah. I just hope they don't get used to it. Said Jose, nice. Which I just thought, oh yeah, I just hope they don't get used to it, the crowd meaning, get used to losing like this, because, you know, when you start accepting defeats just because you played well, just because your players gave their best, when you get used to that, that's when big clubs stop being big clubs. And I thought, yeah, okay, fair enough. At the same time though, what is the alternative? Like, what's Jose saying? Should the Chelsea fans hold up sign saying the three rats, Mount Abraham, Tomori. Like, you know.
An already toxic atmosphere at Frank Lampard's Chelsea.
I felt as though the encouraging atmosphere of the crowd definitely did help Chelsea in the game. You know, if you compare it to, say, that's Sarri or that's Villas-Boas or Benitez or Grant or one of these unpopular managers that Chelsea have had, if that's them in the dugout and it's 2-0 and there's half an hour to go, the whole place is in uproar. They've probably picked out a player or two to abuse or vent their frustration at. Definitely they're not singing the manager's name. And when you do actually do those things, or, you know, support the players and manager, despite the evidence of what's going on, it can help. I think there was some evidence of that. So Mourinho obviously jealous that he would not have been accorded the same indulgence by the crowd, which is fair enough. But look, you, I think, Owen, were eating donuts with David Moyes and watching Man City.
Watford, yeah. Thrash 8 goals. Well, it's, yeah, David Moyes brought in some donuts. I had a toffee crisp donut. Anyway, they're all, you know, donuts these days, Ken.
Yeah.
It's not simply jam or chocolate anymore. Bit of custard in there.
Yeah.
And they're actually modelled after chocolate bars and sweets of various forms. So, yeah, very, very tasty.
Huge variation.
Big thanks to David Moyes. Also, thanks to David Moyes for on air comparing my beard to that of Kike Sanchez Flores.
Oh, right. Okay. Your tear streaked beard.
Made a gag about that, which was good.
That's good.
I didn't really know how to come back.
I'm surprised.
I just have footage of this. Dumbstruck.
I am.
Oh, I might dig it out for you for tomorrow.
I'm surprised.
If you're interested.
David Moyes is a donut man. Seems to be a trim man.
Did he eat any donuts? So that's the thing.
Probably didn't. He just brings some as a gesture.
I think he might have had a donut. Yeah.
Fair play to him.
I can't confirm or deny. I was too focused on all the goals raining in.
I mean, Ben Foster's quotes. This guy maybe has a future in management. I was over the moon to get in at 5-0 at halftime. From a goalie's point of view, it's just relentless. They all do it together. Their shape is incredible. All absolute specimens of men. This, like, he's just, whoa, that was amazing. That truly was an incredible experience to be part of.
Who did you say said that?
That was the Watford goalkeeper, Owen Ben Foster. I think Watford are struggling with some of the kind of sense of anti-climax that haunts Tottenham as well this season. Having, you know, because in their case it was getting to the FA Cup final and then being destroyed 6-0 by Man City, who keep beating them. Like Flores, Kike Sanchez Flores said something like, we have bad memories every time we play against them. The press conference 2 days ago, someone told me our record reminds me how the scores are against City. It's like a prophecy or something. It's like we're scared to play against Manchester City. They have lost 6 goals to City now 3 times in 2 seasons. 6-6 and 8.
I don't know. It really looked like it was going to equal the 9-0.
Oh, completely. Yeah.
You know,
well, 5-0 after 18 minutes. You thought, well, they're going to get 10-0 here.
Yeah. Although what often happens is teams, you know, they just back off or they get a bit bored or whatever. Just because of the, in fairness, that was also the theme of our build up pre-match. Like because of last week, and then losing, there was never going to be. It was a very bad time for Watford to have to play Manchester City, having lost them 6-0, and then having watched them lose a game last week.
Oh,
okay, fair enough. They did lose 2 on the hop last season around Christmas, which was absolutely bizarre. But it was just very, very... They were never going to lose Watford. And if they were going to get ahead, they were going to continue scoring goals, which they did. And really, there was... You know, Aguero should have had a few goals. He only got 1. Yeah. De Bruyne missed a sitter in the last couple of minutes.
He could scored have easily an amazing goal as well.
Yeah, great goal.
I love that De Bruyne goal. Just absolutely hammered it in. The hero of the game, I suppose, if you had to pick an individual, it would be Bernardo Silva. But unfortunately, since then, Bernardo Silva was then on Twitter and he had tweeted a photo. He tweeted a kind of photo comparison. It was guess who? And there was a little, in one photo, there's a little kid. I mean, you've all seen this. Why am I even describing this? But just in case. One of them is a little kid wearing a France jersey. He's obviously Benjamin Mendy. I mean, you can kind of, you know, looking at his familiarity, it is Benjamin Mendy. And then the other photo is of the logo of a Spanish confectionery brand, Congitos. Congitos are kind of a little chocolate peanut. Congito itself means like little person from the Congo. Mm-hmm. This is dating from, I think, the early 60s. And it's just a little... well, like a kind of a little racially stereotypical portrayal of a black person with big red lips and so on. And he tweets this, guess who? It's like a lookalike. you can imagine the reaction to this was not great from the internet, and he deleted it quickly for everything. But then he tweeted, "Can't even joke with a friend these days, you guys." And it was a facepalm emoji. Like, he was kind of, I can't believe.
So not exactly an apology.
I can't believe everyone was taking that seriously, sort of thing. And then Bernardo Silva, this other video then starts getting tweeted around, which is Bernardo Silva, like from his Instagram or whatever. And this, I don't know exactly when this was, but it's not in the last couple of days or whatever, I guess. And he's there. He starts this Instagram story going, "Oh, you know, there's a world champion running around here entirely naked. It's crazy. You know, he's got a bag, I think, maybe a watch, but he's totally naked." And he's kind of, "Let me show you. I'll show you." And he kind of walks up, and then suddenly it's Mendy, who's wearing like a black T-shirt.
Yeah, okay.
And you're like, "All right, Enid Blyton, like, you know, steady on here. Like, what's going on?" And they're like, "Oh, well, you know, why are you not wearing any clothes? You know, Mendy's like, yeah, you know, whatever." And so this is kind of it. Like, he's like bloody Justin Trudeau at this point, Bernardo Silva. Like, what's going on here? Like, but the question is, like, what? You know, Bernardo Silva is making these like gags with his mate Benjamin Mendy. Yeah. Bernard Mendy. Why do I always say Bernard for his name?
I don't know.
Benjamin. Without the kind of, without apparently realizing that this is not really considered to be an appropriate form of humor.
I'm amazed he wasn't pulled up on that last one, on the one that you said, the Insta story that has only come to light now.
I don't know when that was. Like, yeah. You know, I mean, it's kind of one of these things where, like, you know, as has been happening with sort of Trudeau or whatever,
things are popping up.
It's like suddenly there's
people's,
like,
past.
What is there, any more instances of this sort of thing? I mean, you know, it's kind of curious. Like, I mean, I mentioned Enid Blyton because that's a children's author. When I was a child, I remember reading some of her books. I don't know if you ever had the pleasure.
Sure, I did, but now that you say it, please don't push me any further, because I can't think of anything.
She had a few different series, like The Famous Five, The Secret Seven, yeah. Noddy was perhaps, you know, looking back, Noddy was an interesting one, looking back. It was a kind of a Noddy in, I forget the place where he lived was called, but essentially he was this kind of weird little puppet thing. And then there was lots of fairies, creatures there, one of which was the Gollywog. Now, I have to admit that as a child, I didn't realize that a Gollywog was actually a racist caricature. I didn't grasp the racist import of this Gollywog. I thought that it was, remember, there was the sweets as well. There was, if you got like a 10p bag or something like this of sweets, they would often have that little golly sweet.
Mm, yeah.
Right. I did not at this point grasp when I was small. I'm not sure exactly at what point I twigged. I kind of thought it was like just a fairy creature that lived in Enid, that seemed to densely populate the stories of Enid Blyton. You know, she had a big preoccupation with them. I sort of just took that for granted.
As a kid does. I mean, you tend not to.
As a kid, you know, you're not sort of looking at things for, the idea of like a racist stereotype doesn't really occur to you living, you know, as I was in a kind of a fairly monoracial society with a fair,
you didn't think about race much, let alone racism. Yeah.
No, it wasn't really something. And, you know, again, I'm not sure exactly what point I sort of made the connection when I was like, oh, right, I see what, okay. Now, it seems to me as though Bernardo Silva is like in his sort of mid-20s and kind of at the same phase, evidently, you know, with the Conguitos thing. This is like evidently a beloved Spanish confectionery brand. They have updated the logo that he tweeted, in fact, already was updated. A spear had been removed from the little creature. They've now, it seems, been updated further, so they now look kind of more neutral, like, you know, UEFA tournament mascots, yeah, like little computer-generated characters. But evidently, he still kind of lives in this, you know, it hasn't occurred to him that this is bad. You know, he's joking like this with Mendy. The FA supposedly investigating him, and how they handle the case is going to be interesting, because clearly, if you're going to have a zero tolerance policy, then you have to punish Silva for this. You know what I mean? Which I think will to some people seem to be unfair, but at the same time, without these things, then how do you ultimately get there? I mean, he's kind of like, oh, it's just a joke, and clearly that's how he means it.
Just a joke, and it's just me messing around with a friend. Like, he actually, is that what he actually said? Oh, you can't make a joke with a friend anymore.
Yes.
So maybe, I don't know how many actually thinks about it, but in that video that you mentioned, he's sort of laughing along, you know. So, in Bernardo Silva's mind, oh, sure, Mendy finds it funny.
Yeah.
What's everyone's big problem with it?
Yeah, exactly. But then, you know, you're sort of like, okay, well, where do you draw the line? Like, say, if you look at what's happening with Peter Beardsley, you know, Peter Beardsley has been involved in this case of bullying and so on and so forth. And some of the reported comments that he made, you know, include this type of racist banter. You know what I mean? I'm sure that he would probably think, well, I was just joking. But, like, it doesn't matter if that's what you thought. That's not necessarily how people feel about it. We'll maybe come back to that a little bit later. Just on the other game, we're going to talk to Laurie Whitwell in more detail about the Manchester United or the West Ham Man United game. I did wonder if this Sky panel was just going to degenerate into the spectacle of pure sadism. With these three particular pundits analysing Manchester United defeat. There was no Paul Pogba, so they couldn't all get stuck into him. Manchester United were really bad and looked to have absolutely no ideas, again, with missing Pogba. I do notice he gets criticised a lot when he plays, but people don't seem to make the connection between his absences and these type of very kind of lifeless performances from Manchester United. But, you know, what can you do about that? Keane in this one was saying, look, there has to be pressure on him. You can't be saying we've got a 2 or 3 year plan. You've got to win football matches consistently. Again, what's the alternative? Just sack Solskjaer now? Is that what it is? Just sack him now after 6 matches?
So take a time machine and go back to last season and not panic and give him the contract straight away.
Yeah, I mean, we can talk about that game in more detail. I would like to say I don't think West Ham were good. I don't think this West Ham team, they don't impress me at all. I thought, you know, I wouldn't have backed them to win this game beforehand, even though United have not been playing well, and their recent record of this ground against United is not bad. Well, in home matches, I should say. I still wouldn't have backed them to win, but in the end, they won by 2. So it's 10 defeats in 19 since PSG for Solskjaer. It's relegation form over the last 19 games. The last 19 matches are a 38-point season. They're not all league matches, incidentally. But in the league, it's 16 goals scored in the last 17. Like, this is not good.
I don't know what's worse. If that had all happened in one season, which is pretty bad, or if that happens with the summer break in between it and your chance to regroup and put your own imprint on it and buy players and all those kinds of things. And it just hasn't improved.
And the what they're doing is opening up space for Leicester City. Mm. Leicester, who they beat last week. They beat Leicester.
They weren't great that day either, but they won, I suppose.
They weren't great. But Leicester, you know, beating Tottenham. Harry Kane scoring an unbelievable goal. I mean, there's a few people tweeting me over things that I've been saying about both Kane and James Maddison. James Maddison, who I'd suggested maybe wasn't as humble as all that, but also was the Coutinho comparison maybe a little premature from Brendan Rodgers? Well, he scored a Coutinho goal. He turned up with a £6,500 handbag or backpack. Did you see it? The Louis Vuitton?
I'm looking at it.
Remarkable.
Yes. Yeah. How would you even describe this? There's a see-through element to it, but there's also,
I think it's just shimmering.
It just breaks
the light up like a prism.
Oh, so it's not see-through at all. No.
I don't think so. It sort of has all the colours of the spectrum. It's and apparently is £6,500. But look, if it works for him.
Well, I did see the Sun football game. I know you, I don't know if you want to be on the side of this tweet. James Maddison arrives for Spurs clash wearing horrific £6,500 backpack.
Yeah.
And then Ben Chilwell, his teammate, later after the game retweeted, I've just seen him stuffing the Man of the Match trophy in it too.
Yeah.
Crying laughing face. Which I like Ben Chilwell's
tweet. He also said, what would have been more embarrassing, this is Maddison, that is, in terms of, you know, I suppose, walking around with a copy of the Sun newspaper.
Oof.
This was his. So he's now attacked or zinged both the Sun and Jeremy Clarkson in the short space of time after they had a go at him, on social media, scoring continued that goal. So maybe I spoke too soon in suggesting that comparison was premature. And he was saying, look, we're a big team now, Leicester City. We're a big team. And I was kind of thinking, yeah, mate, they actually won the league just before you joined. But now they're a big team. Okay, fair enough. It's like I saw Rice also was saying, oh, Cresswell, you know, he's, you know, Rice, just this big kind of goofy, positive presence on camera. You know, he's just got one of the best left foots I've ever seen. And I was like, you're 20, mate, shut up. You know, you can't actually come. This is probably because of the influence of Michael Owen and his concern with hierarchy. It's just getting into my head. It's like you can, it's like Owen had a thing of, I couldn't just go up to Tony Adams after that game against Argentina and say, you know, congratulations on a great career, mate. You know, I was 18. But Rice is just, has no problem. Just, yeah, Cresswell's 10 years older than me. Yeah, he's got one of the best left foots I've ever seen. You know, all credit to Cresswell.
There's a winning mentality. I can see it in their eyes. They've got glazed eyes.
Glazed eyes. Glazed eyes.
What I said to him at the end, and I'm not ashamed to say it, I said, are you ready to win a World Cup? Because we're in it to win it.
They've got to trust me. I'm taking these guys into battle. Yeah. And I'm doing my own stapling.
Look, we're not getting carried away, but we're now getting to that point now where we are inspiring.
Does a struggling salesman start turning up on a bicycle? He turns up in a newer car, Perception.
So what becomes of you, my love?
Along the way, we're going to have fun.
When they have finally stripped you off.
I try and laugh several times a day.
The handbags and the glad rags. And your granddad has to swear so you.
A sergeant major spends all his time training his men to be killers
and make sure that they arrive for meetings on time and dressed in the right way.
He doesn't polish his own boots. The bosses are panicking. They're going, oh, cut back.
Non-negotiable. The way we play football is non-negotiable.
Gabriele Marcotti is on to talk Chelsea-Liverpool. Gabriele, hope you're keeping well.
All good, although I need to remind you contractually that I am a senior writer at ESPN.
A senior writer.
I stress a senior writer.
Oh, indeed.
Because there is more than one senior writer.
Oh, okay. Are there any junior writers that you can lord it over? Or just the big dogs?
No. We have a lot of generals, but yes.
Well, what did this... What did this senior writer think about the Liverpool performance yesterday? Maybe not their most comprehensive win, but it was a tricky away game. They got the job done. This might be a strange question on the weekend that Manchester City almost matched the Premier League record for a margin of victory. But have Liverpool cemented or become the favourites for the league in your title? In your opinion?
I mean, look, I think we'll get a better sense of it later on. I mean, for me, I would still lean towards City, but what really, really impressed me about Liverpool, I think they showed a maturity. There was sort of an essential quality to the game that hasn't always been there. And you know, this was the sort of game that, you know, 2 years ago, Liverpool might have well lost, even last year, or at least drawn. You know, in the end, you know, you're talking about a game in which I thought, you know, except for Firmino, the rest of the front three wasn't particularly good. I thought the midfield struggled at times. I thought the defense was a little loopy. But then you had two set pieces and you score two goals. And you sort of weather the storm. And you do so with confidence and experience at the back. So, you know, these are the kind of games that I think, you know, belong to a mature team, a team that can still improve, of course, and maybe did things that get a little nervy. But, you know, this is a side of Liverpool that, you know, like I said, wasn't there 12 months ago.
I mean, the interesting thing, the thing that really struck me about the game was how enthusiastic the home crowd was for Chelsea, even though when you look at it, the results have not been too good under Lampard. I mean, they still haven't won a game at home. They have won 2 matches out of 8. But the crowd seems to be really delighted with things. What is your analysis of what's going on there?
Well, I mean, I don't think it's surprising. I mean, Frank Lampard was hugely loved. It's the same way that, you know, a lot of United fans still think that Ole Gunnar Solskjaer is on the right track.
Do they?
Yeah, there is a whole, you know, it's a very broad church there. But, like, I don't know if it's going to be like this in perpetuity, but Lampard, hugely popular, has said all the right things, has done the right things. You know, he plays very attractive football. But I also think, you know, there is a bit of a siege mentality, which is what happens when, you know, there's a transfer ban in place and you kind of have to hunker down as a club and weather the season. And, you know, people aren't going to turn on Lampard when you consider that, you know, he's had to make do with players who were already there or players who are out on loan. You know, throw in the fact that he's actually playing the loan kids and will play presumably, you know, even more of the homegrown kids when well, not that Loftus-Cheek is a kid, but you know, at some point this season, you know, Chelsea could have as many as 7 homegrown players in their starting 11, and 6 of them guys who've been at the club since before they were 10 years old, which is pretty remarkable. And you're going to be on board with that, I think, you know, and you're not going to necessarily, you know, judge his team by the standards that you would have applied to Conte or Mourinho.
Does that siege mentality then, in response to the transfer ban, the kind of, you know, let's get behind the manager feeling at Stamford Bridge, give you confidence ahead of potential no-deal Brexit? You know, in terms of, you know, when things go wrong, you know, and you get cut off from the world, sometimes you've just got to fall back on your own talent, that maybe people will row in, you know, accept that there are going to be setbacks, but, you know, maybe in a year's time, Britain could be producing its own coffee, you know, could be producing its own tobacco, could have become sort of self-sufficient. And in fact, that things might actually work out a lot better than people are expecting.
You know, yeah, I'm not going to fall for that. I'm not allowed to speak politics, but I love your analogy. I would say that to continue with the analogy, football-wise, Chelsea isn't Britain. Britain is a highly specialized economy, and they simply don't produce a lot of things, partly because of the climate, partly because they don't have the infrastructure, partly because they've forgotten how to do certain things. Chelsea, on the other hand, in the football sphere, has spent the last 15 years or so basically building up its production line. And, you know, in that sense, Britain is Britain, and Chelsea would be like, I don't know, the United States, maybe somebody who could theoretically be self-sufficient because okay. Their landscape is so varied that they can produce a lot of the products that they need. So maybe that's the analogy. I mean, Chelsea have this remarkable
industrial,
this
base.
Remarkable youth academy. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean that Britain as a country, you know, from what I can tell anyway, doesn't have and would take a long time to build.
Well,
doesn't mean it can't be done, but, you know, it would take a while.
I mean, there have been lots of young players. I think Tomori was the one who Lampard singled out for praise yesterday. Obviously, Mason Mount, Tammy Abraham have been going really well this season. There is one young super talent at Stamford Bridge who isn't getting much of a look in at the moment. Even though the game yesterday, I thought, might have been a game for him, but all those crossfield balls from Jorginho stretching the defence and the wingers running onto it. Well, the wingers weren't Christian Pulisic, I think I should say. Christian Pulisic, who is the, you know, the big hero of American soccer, and, you know, just been left out, I think, of the last 3 matches by Frank Lampard. I saw a tweet from Miguel Delaney yesterday, a third game with no Pulisic appearance. The considerable US media contingent following Chelsea now may soon become like the Japanese group for a few years at Arsenal, with Maichi asking the manager how he trained.
Yeah, I mean, so I think the reason this resonates a little bit more is that Pulisic went on international break and then kind of came back early and then didn't get to play. He had a stinker of a season last year. He was also injured, of course, as well. But, you know, he didn't play particularly well. You know, he's a hero. I wouldn't describe him as a hero as much as a hero apparent, perhaps, for the U.S., because let's not forget, you know, he was part of the team that failed to qualify for the 2018 World Cup, which, when you belong to CONCACAF, it's pretty freaking embarrassing when you don't qualify when you have the money and the resources that the U.S. has. So he's not hero status yet. He's got the tools to become a very, very good footballer. But maybe even a transformational footballer. But, you know, the kid's 20 years old. Let's not forget that. And I think from Lampard's perspective, I fully understand, you know, why maybe he hasn't featured in those games. There is a lot of competition in those wide paces. You've got Willian, you have Pedro, you have Mason Mount when you go 4-3-3. And so kind of makes sense to me. I think we probably would have seen him, but let's not forget also, Chelsea lost two of their back four, of their starting back four in the first half. Mm. And I think that played into it as well. You know, he was forced to burn two substitutions before halftime.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I guess that is true. He could have come in. But you mentioned that he's 20 years old. I mean, he's been kept out of the team by a 20-year-old. You know, in Mason Mount played where I guess Pulisic could have played yesterday. You know, maybe Willian as well. Okay, he's a hugely experienced player. But, you know, it's not as though he's been kept out of the team by, you know, legendary Chelsea players. He's been kept out of the team by other young players. And, you know, when Lampard talks about him, he sort of doesn't really want to go into it. He just says, it's just my decisions. Do you think that he does have faith in Pulisic's, his baseline ability, his potential?
Well, look, he's being kept out of the side by another young player, but it's a young player who spent all of last season playing for Frank Lampard at Derby County. So presumably will have more familiarity with what Lampard wants of him. Although that said, you know, presumably he'll be even further behind in the queue when Callum Hudson-Odoi returns. But like the tools are there. What I find really odd about Pulisic is, you know how Chelsea signed him in January and then they kind of left him on loan at Dortmund rather than bringing him over straight away, even though they knew that the transfer ban was coming. It struck me as so odd. And he came out and he said, oh, no, well, I'm going to stay here so I can get fit, so I can get ready for preseason at Chelsea. I'm thinking to myself, like, wait a minute. You're moving to a new club and you think you'll be better prepared staying at Dortmund where you basically, you know, you're now a reserve, then moving to your new club, finding your feet, adapting to London, adapting to the environment. I just thought that was a very, very, very odd decision.
Was it because Sarri didn't want him? I mean, I don't know this, but I do remember that at that time, Sarri was under lots of pressure to pick Callum Hudson-Odoi, and he might have thought, look, the last thing I want is another undercooked 20-year-old winger. Especially one who's been signed for an enormous amount of money and people are going to expect to see in the team. You know, don't bother bringing this guy in yet.
You know, some people made that point. I am 99.9% sure that unless I've been lied to, Sarri would have been very happy and content to have him. Because don't forget, too, about Pulisic. Pulisic can also play center forward. And has done. And of course, last season, you know, you had Higuain coming over and not playing particularly well. And you had Giroud. So he would have been somebody who gave you something very, very different. So, look, the point is that he was injured anyway, right? So, and then he'd had niggly injury. So it's not like he would have, you know, he would have thrown shade on Hudson-Odoi or anybody else. You know, I think the fact is he could have been there, prepared properly, recuperated properly, and been ready for this season. Instead, the decision was made for whatever reason not to do that. And I think it's probably one that he regrets.
What did you make of the VAR controversy, if it was one, in this game? There were a lot of them over the weekend. I mean, this was the offside goal. It was disallowed for Chelsea. Legitimate offside, certainly. And the issue that people have, I guess, is that it was so far back in the move and it felt like an inconsequential enough part of it. It was just like a bog-standard pass, which only really began the move. Do you have any issue with it?
Like, I'm not a referee. I do know that they have very specific rules when it comes to phase of play. As long as those rules were applied, I'm okay with it. It does feel weird. Not so much, you know, I guess the argument is that it was the same phase of play because even though Liverpool touched the ball in between, they never had control of it and it was still all seen as part of the same Chelsea attack. If that's what the rules say, that's what the rules say. I mean, I'm more concerned by other things with VAR and I continue to be utterly mystified by some people's reactions to it.
Why? What do you mean by that?
Oh my God! The this nonsense with Heung-min Son the other day. I mean, really? What bugs me is, listen, If you philosophically opposed to VAR, great, fine. Much respect to you. I genuinely respect that opinion.
It doesn't sound like it.
No, that's fine. It's not one I share, but that's fine.
Okay.
At least I understand that opinion.
Right.
What I can't understand is how people think that saying, oh, but if it's close, then you should let it go, because that's completely nonsensical. The reason that these things get let go, the reason people don't flag, is because assistants have been told not to flag. And they've been told not to flag for the obvious reason that if somebody's incorrectly ruled offside and scores a goal, you know, you can't, or, and he would have scored a goal, you can't go back and have him try to shoot on goal again, right?
Hmm.
So the whole parameter is different. If you're going to come up with a different solution to it, you have to offer some kind of an alternative. You know, if he's offside, he's offside. If you want to come up with a different system where maybe assistants do flag on close calls the way they've always done before, hey, that's fine. But then you're going to get a whole bunch of people. You're going to get a whole bunch of mistakes where, you know, afterwards we look at VAR and we say, oh, look, actually so-and-so was offside and he might have scored, or was onside rather, and he might have scored. But we'll never know because the linesman put his flag up. Oh, shame. And then people are going to say, well, what the hell is VAR for? I simply don't understand that. I don't understand people going on like, oh, look, but, you know, it's his shoulder, it's his head, but his feet were in line. That's what the rules say.
Yeah,
that's
but
what the rules say. Not now. Not now that evil VAR has been come in by evil UEFA and the European Union and others. That's what the rules have been for the past, what, the past 10 years?
But, Cabrera, is part of the issue here not that, you know, this idea that technology is this all-encompassing power that we can't ever doubt. There's been plenty written about how actually it's not possible for the technology that's currently in play to 100% fully adjudicate whether or not it is an offside. And it doesn't fill you full of confidence when you're watching it on TV and you're seeing them putting those little lines on the defender and then the little line on the attacker and adjusting them. And it just seems a little bit haphazard.
Owen, so first of all, I assume that your television, like mine, is a two-dimensional television, yes?
Yeah, yeah.
So inevitable, when you're doing 3D images and you're trying to render it in two dimensions, it's not going to look right. Okay, so that's the first point. So the fact that it doesn't look right. The Jonathan Wilson frames per second argument, which I know you're going to go there. You know what? However, frames per second, and by the way, I think there's a lot of criticism that can be done of his mass and the kind of cameras they use.
Not for the first time.
Surely Jonathan Wilson will recognize that whatever the frames per second are, they're still quicker and more accurate than the human eye, right?
Yeah.
So but all you're doing is giving somebody more tools and more information to make this judgment. And as for the margin of error, you know, people don't seem to realize there's a margin of error on goal line technology as well, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Nobody seems to care about that. Nobody seems to question that. You know, goal line technology, goal, no goal, goal decision system. Oh, you know, the Oracle has spoken. Let's all accept that. But suddenly with this, it becomes a big issue.
Yeah, yeah. I guess the difference is the human eye doesn't make the claim to infallibility, which is kind of implicitly there with VAR. But look, we could argue about that. This nonsense. Although, while we have you, I just wanted to ask...
Hit me up on Twitter, whether it's you or somebody else, come up with a better solution. As far as I can see it, the only solution is eliminate VAR for offsides entirely, if that's what you want to do, or otherwise, keep the system as it is. There is no possible system that incorporates VAR and that is better than this one. And why people get so bent out of shape, I really don't understand this.
Yeah. Yeah. While we have you, I wanted to ask about one other thing, which was it was the Milan Derby last night in your hometown. The
Saturday night.
Sorry. Inter won the game 2-0. Good goal by Romelu Lukaku, the second goal in this one. And he scored 3 and 4 so far in the league for Inter. And he seems to be going reasonably well on the field anyway. I wondered, what's the situation? You know, has there been any more kind of fallout from, obviously this thing happened at Cagliari where he was abused by the crowd, and then this mad letter was written by an Inter ultras group where they tried to explain that, you know, in fact, this wasn't racism. It was kind of a strange gesture of respect from the Calgary fans and so on. You know, we all heard that. How has Lukaku sort of been settling down? I mean, is his policy just to sort of kind of pretend as though all that stuff didn't happen and continue just focusing on what's happening on the pitch?
Well, so first of all, he scored, he works hard, people really like him. I don't think he's played particularly well. He's also had back spasms as well, which have hurt him. But his, you know, what he said, I think has been correct. It's been impeccable. This ultras letter, there's a lot we could say about it. The gist of the letter isn't that it's a sign of respect. The gist of the letter is that from this particular ultras group, which, by the way, I know people have seen it reported as if, like, you know, they were speaking for all inter ultras or speaking for all inter fans. This is a group with like 200 to 300 people on Facebook, right? So let's be clear upon that, you know, about this, you know, who was sending this letter. But the crux of the issue, the crux of the point they were making, isn't that it's a gesture of respect. And I don't think it's mad at all. It's the way a lot of people genuinely see it, incorrectly, in my opinion, but it's how they see it, which is that we're not racist in real life. We're a multicultural, multiracial group, in fact, which Court of Honor actually are. But we believe that in a football match, we have the right to get into an opponent's head and abuse them any which way we like. Including in a way that, you know, this week is racist, another week might be homophobic or anti-Semitic or sectarian or whatever. We believe that inside a stadium, you're allowed to abuse your opponent any way you like to give your team an edge. And we think that's what the Cagliari fans, and we wanted to reassure Lukaku that, you know, he's not being the victim of racism, but they're abusing him because, as you said, they respect him and they respect his ability anyway, and they want to abuse him and destabilize him because they fear him. Now, like, I don't need to tell you that whatever these people think is utterly irrelevant. Nobody should be subject to any kind of racist abuse in their workplace. And even not just a person, but even like the people who just witness it, nobody should be made to witness this. But it is how a lot of people genuinely view the situation. And I think we spend too much time worrying about, you know, we spend too much time calling them racist and then having them go back and say we're not racist or whatever, worrying about definitions, making a big deal of societal problems. We should focus on one thing, safeguarding the stadiums to make sure that certain kinds of abuse are never heard, and that if people do it, they are subject to very, very serious punishment. That's all that I think you need to focus on right now if you really do want to make a change. You know, then the hot air and the waffling and the condemnation, you know, we've had all that. Personally, I don't think it helps. So, and I think what's pretty obvious is that they need to come up with better ways of doing that. Enforcing the laws which are already there would be a start. There was an incident in the Atalanta-Fiorentina game just yesterday on Sunday where actually the system did what it was supposed to do. Dalbert, a Fiorentina player of color, was racially abused by some fans. Most people didn't hear it. Dalbert certainly heard it. The referee heard it. The assistant heard it. And the referee did what the protocol says he should do, an announcement over the loudspeaker, interrupt the game, and say, if this happens again, we're all walking off the pitch. This should be the norm for how you deal with this. It's only part of the solution. There's other things that you need to do as well. But, you know, seeing the laws applied is a start. And what's shameful and unacceptable is that these basic laws weren't applied when Lukaku was racially abused in Cagliari, when Frank Kessie was racially abused in Verona. And even worse, the fact that, certainly in the case of Verona, they came and kind of minimized it and kind of made a joke out of it. That is unacceptable. And I think it kind of shows that we still got a long way to go.
Yeah. Well, in that sense, I mean, you've been talking there about how, you know, football can try to at least protect the stadiums and stop this from happening in the stadium. But would that suggest, and say this Bernardo Silva thing that happened over the weekend where, you know, the FA supposedly is looking into this, the tweet that he posted about Benjamin Mendy With the Congitos logo, and then you know he deleted that, and he said, "Oh, you can't joke with a friend anymore. This is ridiculous." And I see the Kick It Out have said this is a discriminatory tweet and so on. Are you suggesting that maybe this is something which needn't fall within the sort of purview of the authorities? This kind of it's one thing to try to ensure that we don't have like racist outrages in the stadium. But that sort of policing what people say on social media may not be a helpful policy.
No, I'm not saying at all. I mean, Kick It Out's job is to eliminate racism in football, or limit it at least as best they can, right? So, by all means, they should get involved. What I am saying is that, you know, there's racism and there's racist abuse, which may or may not have racism behind it. But I don't want to get into a conversation of semantics, because you waste a whole bunch of time by saying this was not racist. I think most people would probably, and Bernardo Silva is a good example. I mean, Bernardo Silva and Mendy are supposedly friends. I don't think anybody would suggest that Bernardo Silva's intent in sending that was to racially abuse his teammate. But that doesn't change the fact that that is an offensive representation. It's one that's rooted in history, that it's hurtful, to people. And at the very least, Kick It Out should get involved and educate Bernardo Silva about why that is a very inappropriate thing to post. What happens between Bernardo Silva and Mendy in private is their business. You know, maybe Mendy thought it was hilarious and he enjoys it. But once you post it on social media, it's not just Mendy who's seeing it. It's not like Bernardo Silva sending him a private WhatsApp and saying, like, yuck, yuck, isn't this funny? And they both have a hearty laugh. I don't know. Once you put it in public, you who represent Manchester City, represent yourself, you are putting a really offensive image out there, and that's not acceptable. And again, do you think Bernardo Silva said, "Oh, guess what? We just won 8-0. Let me go racially abuse Mendy"? You don't believe that, do you?
No, I mean it would be strange for him.
No,
to do that.
Exactly. No sane person believes that. Yeah. But the point I'm trying to get across: it doesn't matter. Your intent only matters so much. It's the action. In the same way that whatever reason some fans might racially abuse a player but say, well, look, I'm not really racist because I'm not racist in real life. It's just, you know, I'm just making a joke, or I'm unsettling him, or I'm doing it, or it's banter, or it's in the course of a football match. It doesn't matter, because once it's out in public, it's out in public, and it becomes deeply offensive and unacceptable to people. I don't think this is something that's so difficult or should be so difficult for me at least to understand.
Okay, Gabriel Marcotti, we'll leave it there. Senior writer with ESPN, the worldwide...
One of many, yeah.
The worldwide leader in sports, is that still the...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, great stuff. Thanks so much.
Take care.
Words alone are not enough. I have to resort to song.
Oh, wow, yeah, okay.
A heart full of love, a heart full of song. I'm doing everything all wrong. Oh God, for shame, I do not even know your name. Dear World Service subscriber, won't you say?
Ken already, Al McDevitt, secondcamps.com. Go on and subscribe, you're not already a member. Great value for money. Better value for money than the license fee, some people would say, Alan. Not me now, obviously, but
not me either, Hugh.
I don't want to put them down, but they seem to want to prove that you don't need to know anything about football to write about it.
What you think doesn't really matter.
The press come and go, as we know. You mentioned Ken Early. Well, yeah. You know, I wouldn't necessarily agree with anything Ken Early says about football.
Second captain, first captain, whatever.
Bang up to date now with My Sad Captains, not to be confused with Second Captains, the equally brilliant Second Captains. It's My Sad Captains.
Sounds to me like Gabrielli's Twitter feed might be busy. At Marcotti, in case you do want to send any suggestions his way as to how to improve the VAR system, particularly around offsides. You're not a VAR fan, Ken, but...
No, I mean...
What's the alternative when it comes to offsides?
Well, the question with the offside thing is how far back do you go to look for the offside?
Well, it's one of the questions. I mean, the other question is, do you believe Jonathan Wilson's math?
Well, I'm rightly sceptical about any figures produced by Jonathan Wilson on the back of an envelope. You know, look, he's had that out on Twitter, and I haven't really sat down and tried to analyze it myself, but I'm sure plenty of people have.
What he had was, can anybody tell me if my working is wrong here? Footballers commonly reach speeds of 25 kilometers per hour, i.e. 6.94 meters per second. Sky HD TV broadcasts at 50 frames per second, if you're still following, i.e. one frame every 0.02 seconds. In 0.02 seconds, a player moving at 25 kilometers an hour travels 138.8 millimeters. When a pass is played, the VAR man presses pause on his video. Even if he always manages to freeze the correct frame, which seems unlikely, how are we pretending that VAR can adjudicate offsides to within a couple of millimetres?
Yeah.
Just to give people the background to that.
No, it's a lie, you know. With science sometimes isn't as precise as it likes to think. I mean, I don't know, maybe one solution. I mean, the Son one was particularly kind of, how can you even tell that's offside? Come on. Like, it doesn't look offside to me. You know, if you were watching this, there was no VAR, you're watching it in replay, you'd be thinking, oh, Son, look how perfectly he's timed his run. And instead they've got like this, well, actually he is fractionally offside. Well, okay, fair enough. But maybe, you know, the point is that previously the idea of level, you get that there's a benefit of the doubt for the attacker. And if that's going to be taken away, then how do you reintroduce that? I mean, that's kind of a concept that was there before.
Yeah.
Do you make that blue line, if it's the blue line for the defender and the red line for the attacker, does the blue line just have to be a little bit fatter? Does it extend, does each side of the line extend a little bit further from the center point of that line, just to introduce that tiny little benefit of the doubt that there may be with the 138 millimeter error in frame rate or whatever? You know, I don't know. But like, this is the kind of nonsense that we're reduced to as a result of this, the introduction of these rules.
Feel free to flood at Marcotti's Twitter feed with some of that nonsense. Another listless performance from Ole Gunnar Solskjaer's boys against West Ham. Laurie Whitwell covers Man United for The Athletic. Good to talk to you, Laurie.
Hey guys, you okay?
We're okay, yeah. Could you put this one to bed first of all? Are West Ham any good? Is there a mitigating circumstance there? Because Ken's not so sure West Ham even had to do a whole lot.
I totally agree with Ken, actually. For the first half an hour, it was very flat. And in fact, just before Yarmolenko scored, the whole stadium had kind of gone into a bit of a slumber. Some people had sort of trotted off to half-time for the, you know, the half-time pies. And then they produced that nice move and really good finish. But I don't think West Ham really did all that much to beat United 2-0, really. Obviously, it's a great free kick from Aaron Cresswell, but it wasn't like they were tearing United apart, and they really had to, you know, produce one of their better displays. I think West Ham have played better and probably drawn matches, which just is a bit more of a damning indictment of where United are at right now.
Yeah, we are still a little bit interested in Declan Rice.
Are we, Ken?
Yeah, we sort of hate watching Declan Rice at the moment. What did you make of him? I mean, I think Manchester United were interested in him. I'm not sure he was interested in making the move at this point, but did he look like the sort of player who could potentially improve them?
I thought he played well, Declan Rice. In fact, a couple of the moments that I flagged up for my Athletic piece in terms of United's attacking inabilities, in terms of sort of putting moves together and actually creating that final pass, Declan Rice was in the right place to make sure that at least those passes were more difficult. So Pereira broke at one point and Rice was there to kind of shield the back four, and then again in the second half when McTominay was coming forward, he dispossessed him. So he had a good game. United were definitely interested in him, but I think it was a quick sort of rebuttal perhaps from the players' point of view, and also the price that West Ham was sort of suggesting as United have found this transfer window. The zeros get added on when they come calling, but I don't know even if Rice at this particular moment would be what United need, because they kind of have a player in Scott McTominay who I have quite a lot of faith in for producing those kind of displays. And even Matic, I've not been his biggest fan at all, but I actually thought he was probably one of United's better players actually yesterday, which probably is a bit of a sign of the kind of performance that United produced, which was obviously one of sort of defensive, intent more than any kind of attacking potential. And so I've got faith in Scott McTominay. So I just wonder if Declan Rice is exactly the kind of player that they need. United, I think they need a creative midfielder, an attacker on the wing or up front. And I don't know if you kind of feel like if Declan Rice went to United right now, he might just get swallowed up in the kind of chasm that a lot of players do seem to fall into at United when they sign there.
Yeah, it's interesting that you mentioned McTominay, and you're a believer in him. I mean, I was watching him yesterday, and I do wonder if he is showing the sort of potential that United should be, you know, need to be looking for in a player in such an important position. You know, he's clearly strong, fit, does all these things. I've seen him knock, you know, a couple of very nice sort of crossfield balls and this sort of stuff. He does have some technical ability, but I kind of wonder a little bit about whether he's quite sharp enough. You know, I mean, there was that moment, I think you've already alluded to it, the one when Rashford got injured. It almost seemed as though Rashford was checking his run so many times he ended up rupturing himself, waiting for the ball from McTominay, which ultimately didn't come. And I kind of thought, you know, that's the kind of moment, you know, you can't, I mean, I'm not Jose Mourinho, I'm not going to write off a player on the basis of one moment that I didn't like. But I do wonder if, you know, are we actually seeing enough? What is it that convinces you about McTominay that he is somebody who they can trust?
Well, yeah, I agree that I don't know if he will ever become that kind of player that will dominate a game in a creative sense. But I just feel that he has a lot of characteristics that United should try and build around at the moment. I know it's probably quite easy to say, you know, United DNA, or he's got the right character. But I do kind of feel there is a stock in that he's been at the club for a long time and he clearly cares, which has not been the case for some players that have obviously come through the door recently. I do think he's got certain techniques that are good and useful. You know, he's got a high energy, good cardiovascular abilities. He can do those passes, as you say. I just felt like yesterday, I agree with you that moment where you want somebody to be decisive and to know in themselves, to have that confidence to produce that final ball, isn't there. And I guess I don't know if he'll ever be that kind of player for United. You know, you hope that Pogba, when he comes back, he is that kind of player. And then McTominay's the one that allows Pogba to do his good work. I kind of equate him a little bit to Darren Fletcher, who I guess maybe you wouldn't say was elite United quality, but he was in, you know, first teams for a number of years, doing a really good job, you know, for Sir Alex Ferguson, contributing important moments. I kind of feel that McTominay's got the work ethic to keep improving. He has improved since he's come into the team. So I do feel there's a place for him in the side.
We've been talking about Chelsea earlier on, around whom there remains this incredible sense of optimism and that great things are happening, even as they slip into the bottom half of the table. Manchester United are soaring above them on goal difference in eighth place. They're both on 8 points. Is there still any vestiges of last season's optimism left, or with all these crushing defeats and mind-numbing performances, what's the sense of what people around the club are thinking about Solskjaer's United?
Yeah, it's a difficult one. It seems to sort of lurch from one sort of idea to the next. You know, when, you know, last week I actually thought the Leicester performance was kind of encouraging against a team that obviously, as we've seen against Spurs at the weekend, have that potential to beat these kind of teams. United, I thought, did a professional job, and I took sort of encouragement from that. And then obviously we see against West Ham where that sort of fritters away into a kind of ponderous display, and that is the kind of performance that you really do walk away from underwhelmed and wonder where the direction is. Obviously that's without Martial, Rashford obviously went off, Pogba, Luke Shaw, so you kind of say that, well, okay, there's mitigating circumstances there. I think in terms of what Solskjaer's trying to do, I think United just have to stick with it, because he ultimately has the club at heart and he is doing interesting things with the younger players, and also with clearing out the decks before, you know, hopefully, you know, mounting more signings in January and next summer. I think there's an acute awareness that they need quality bringing in, but he's determined to make it the right quality, which I think is an admirable stance given that United have signed a lot of players for a lot of money in previous years and it hasn't worked out. I think one comparison I would draw with the Chelsea situation, obviously with Lampard playing Mount and Abraham and Tomori, for example, the kind of younger players that Solskjaer's implementing are players that have played under 23s games previously. They haven't had those loans as Abraham and Mount have had, and Tomori at championship clubs where they've had proper seasons, you know, in kind of men's football. You know, you're looking at Greenwood, Gomez, Chong. Twanzebe, to be fair, actually had a season obviously on loan at Villa and did really well. So I think he's one that could, you know, come into the team more regularly down towards in later months. But I think there needs to be a bit of patience there in the fact that Ollie is trying to give these younger players a chance that haven't previously had that experience in the Championship.
Yeah. Well. One last thing I wondered about, Laurie. I mean, you mentioned that they might be looking to bring players in January. You know, this defeat at West Ham was watched on Sky by this Mourinho, Keane and Souness panel. One of the things Mourinho said was, you see, you know, when I was crying last summer for a central defender, you know, I wasn't like some kind of a madman. We obviously needed one. You know, he was obviously making his usual self-justifying or self-serving point. But obviously, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer hasn't done any moaning of that nature. You know, he's kind of been a company man in the sense of everyone's on message about the transfer policy. But I wonder, in your opinion, how would the summer transfer activity have looked different from what it has been if Ole Gunnar Solskjaer had got his way? You know, if he'd got everything he'd wanted in terms of players he wanted to bring in and players he wanted to bring out.
Well, I'm told that Solskjaer pretty much got not what he wanted, because obviously, ideally, he would have wanted, you know, more players coming in. The only one time he sort of suggested that the business didn't go to his liking was when he said, yes, we may be light in a striker department. And he kind of only admitted that after the window had closed. So, but I don't know if that was, from what I've been told, I don't know if that was a sort of instruction or a kind of ruling by Woodward and the board, more than Solskjaer actually saying, no, I want to clear out the players that don't want to be here or that I don't think should be here. And obviously, they did more than any season previously. They've managed to do that. And then also the players that he brought in were definitely his signings, Wan-Bissaka, James, Maguire, all players, you know, young, sort of British, on an upward trajectory, which I think was the most important thing, that, you know, you've got players here now that are actually feeling like United is the biggest stage that they will perform on. So you hope that then, you know, engenders displays from them of that ilk. I don't know. I think he definitely wanted another striker. The Jadon Sancho thing, I know he's not a striker as such, but they obviously looked at him strongly, but Dortmund and I guess the player just weren't interested, which is a sign of where United are at and a sign of how hard it's actually going to be to bring in these players that will improve the team to a discernible level. So you look at Christian Eriksen as well. That was another one that they definitely tried hard to do. And, you know, Eriksen basically wanted Madrid, wanted to hold out for that, see where it comes. I believe that they'll try again in January and see where his head's at, see if Real actually do want Eriksen in the summer. So, you know, there's a few movable parts there, but I think he's another one that they'd look at. I think also they, you know, looked at Longstaff and they just thought the price quoted by Newcastle was too much. So there was areas where they could have added, but I do think ultimately Solskjaer had the final say. But then again, you go back to ultimately, is the structure there in place for him to have the best chance of getting these kind of players? You know, you look at City and Liverpool and clearly they've got a very refined system for that kind of thing, and United just isn't there.
Laurie Whitwell of The Athletic, great to talk to you. Thanks so much.
Thanks, guys.
It's very difficult to see Arsenal play one day without Arsenal on the bench.
He's going to ruin the club, fam. He's going to ruin the club, lad. I'm telling you, fam.
But up and down the land, you do sense a genuine appreciation for the way this Arsenal team play. They were perfect.
It's turning. It's turning, blood. Did you hear the booze at full time? Seriously, shut the fuck up tonight. I'm not in no mood for no little dickheads chatting shit.
We love to have him there all the time, but we all know that's not going to happen. One day he's going to have to go.
It's
Spineless. Where were they in the second half? Spineless. No fucking character. No fucking leadership. Where does that boil down to? It boils down to the fucking manager. He's finished.
It will be hard. He's not thinking of leaving one day.
He was a great manager. He's gone. He's gone.
It will happen eventually. We all know it. But I don't see it.
Arsenal Football Club, then.
For me, the day I will see Arsenal play without Arsene on the bench, it's going to be weird.
Don't the fan base of this fucking club.
Don't try to question my fan base. No. Don't try to question my fan base,
the
okay?
Fan base,
you can't
right.
listen.
I can't get angry like I have before because it's just.
Arsene Wenger's team, every bit as good as the manager's words. He had no doubts. They are the champions. They have taken the title away from Manchester United, and they have done it here at Old Trafford. It does not get more conclusive than that.
Right, so Manchester United and Chelsea locked together in mid-table on 8 points.
Tottenham at 8 points. Loads of teams have 2-2-2.
After
I think there's
points.
About six teams that have the record of win 1-2, drawn 2, lost 2. Which includes Chelsea, Manchester United and Tottenham.
What's your prediction now with those three big teams who are lower than they should be? Who's going to finish top of that slow horse race? Forget about even top four. Who knows? Leicester and others could have completely gazumped them by then.
It's impossible to say at this point.
Well, just give us a very quick kind of punchy wrap to the show by giving us one name. Then we can wrap things up. It's been a long football podcast.
I'll say Tottenham.
That's very good. Thanks, Ken.
Thanks, Owen.
Thanks so much for listening. We'll talk to you again on the World Service tomorrow.
That's the second time it's gone off. They never go home, they never go home, they never go home, those boys.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.